From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The partial government shutdown is in its third week with no deal in sight. 800,000 federal workers are impacted. A little less than half are on furlough, meaning they're not working and know they're not getting paid. But more than 400,000 have been labeled essential. They are working, and they're not sure when they'll be paid. Next Friday will be the first paycheck missed. The president was asked about that this weekend. Here's his response.
I can relate, and I'm sure that the people that are on the receiving end will make adjustment. They always do.
Let's bring in Michael Metz, an air traffic controller for the FAA in Albuquerque. Michael, what did you think when you heard the president say that you will, work it out?
I disagree. I am not a very happy camper when it comes to having to work and not know when I'm going to get paid for it.
Well, but, others have pointed out you will get paid eventually when this is over. But what happens? It doesn't look like there's going to be an agreement by Friday. What preemptive things are you doing now, looking ahead to maybe not getting a paycheck?
Well, I've already called my bank and asked to have my car payment deferred, which wasn't a problem. We have a ski trip scheduled for the end of the month that we've put on hold. If it goes until the end of the month, I'll probably have to call my mortgage company and ask about deferring my mortgage payment for the month of February. I've proceeded to talk to my family, and we've talked about what is essential, what is not essential, and we're trying to cut out anything that's non-essential.
Were you instructed at all by the FAA or any organizations, what to do in this time?
There was something that was put out by the FAA about how to contact your bank and they gave us some form letters. But for the most part, being that this isn't my first go around, I've dealt with one through Bill Clinton. I've dealt through one through President Obama. I've dealt through sequestration. I have some money in the savings account, and I'm trying to make that go as long as I can.
You talk about sequestration, the budget debates. You have a very important job. How much pressure, emotional pressure, is that on you to be a political football and be an air traffic controller?
Well, you feel like you're being held hostage for someone else's political agendas. You want to just be able to go into work and do your job. This is why we do what we do. This is what we do. Our job is to make sure that we have the safest airspace in the world. We make sure that planes get from one destination to the other as quickly as possible and as safely as possible. No matter what, we will do that, whether we're working for no pay or whether we're doing our job and we're getting paid normally. That's our job, and that's what you get hired on to do. So it doesn't affect how we do our job or what our job is. It just makes it more stressful when you're at home and you're worried about bills. You're worried about, when is my next paycheck going to come and how am I going to pay for my mortgage? Is the mortgage company going to allow me to defer a payment? Those are the things that become more stressful is the home, not at work. We do what we do and we do it well.
Before we let you go, your thoughts on what we're hearing about TSA workers at airports. They've been calling in sick in higher numbers than usual. These are the security personnel that we all go through to get on a plane. A TSA spokesperson downplayed it, but there are reports, unnamed sources in the New York Times, that this could be a coordinated sick out. Your thoughts on that?
They're doing what they feel they need to do. It's not something that we would ever do as air traffic controllers. That's just wrong. In my opinion, I'm not saying that what they're doing, they're doing what they need to do and what they feel they need to do because they don't get paid a whole lot. So, are they calling in sick so that they can go get a temporary job while they're waiting for this whole thing to be resolved? I don't know, but I think that puts people at risk. And I understand their point of view. It happened during sequestration. As soon as the congressmen and the senators were completely inconvenienced, it got resolved the very next day. and I understand their thought process, but I don't know. I don't agree with it.
No, especially when it comes to an area of security which you work in. Michael Met, air traffic controller in Albuquerque. He's working full-time and eyeing Friday to see if he gets a check and is paid for it. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
U.S. and Chinese delegations opened 2 days of trade talks today in Beijing. They are trying to ease tension triggered when President Trump imposed higher tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports to the U.S. last year. China responded with tariffs of its own on U.S. goods coming into China. Joining us now is NPR Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jeremy.
So yet another round of talks here. What's at stake this time? Is there any expectation that it's going to work?
Yeah, well, there's a lot at stake for both the U.S. and China here. You know, for decades, both economies have grown more intertwined, and these tariffs represent a sort of decoupling of what's become a very close economic relationship that's really defined globalism in all of its facets. So if this trade war continues, both economies are going to suffer. In the U.S., you're going to see higher prices for just about everything you can think of, basically most of your consumer goods. For China, this means a much more slower economy, more unemployment. Jobs that were once there to make products for export to the U.S. are going to shrivel up, and that means problems for Chinese leader Xi Jinping.
So what does the U.S. want heading into these talks, and what does China want?
Well, the Trump administration has a list of demands. It wants Beijing to end its practice of forcing American companies to hand over key technology in return for doing business in China. It wants China to buy more products from the U.S. in order to reduce the trade deficit. And it wants a fairer playing field for U.S. companies inside of China. Beijing is prepared to buy more American products. That's easy enough to meet the demands of hundreds of millions of consumers here. But I think what's going to be difficult for the Chinese side is to level the playing field for U.S. companies inside of China. To do that properly would require significant changes in how China manages its economy, changes that would put the Chinese government and its state-owned enterprises in a vulnerable position. So I think that is the big sticking point from Beijing's perspective.
And all along, as these talks have gone on, there have been questions about how they've been conducted, who's arguing for what from the Trump administration, whether they've got somebody who's really tough on China or somebody who's a little more friendly. Is there a framework for these negotiations? Do we know what's supposed to be on the agenda?
Well, I think the framework was really set up by the Trump administration when it imposed these tariffs last summer. I mean, it did so because it was effectively saying to China, look, you have to stop stealing our technology. You have to stop making it more difficult for U.S. companies to do business in China. You have to start following international rules of fair trade. So in many ways, that agenda has been set by the Trump administration, and they've sort of been in the driver's seat for these negotiations. On the issue of the divisions within the Trump administration, there's definitely a division. You've got Lighthizer, who is the U.S. trade representative, on one side, and I would put him in the same sort of side as Peter Navarro. And then you've also on the other side got Steven Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross, who seem to be more of the free trade wing of the Republican mm-hmm. Party. They would like to solve these problems very quickly. But I think Lighthizer, who comes from the Rust Belt in the United States, an area that has seen a lot of jobs lost to China, I think wants to see if he can use this opportunity to make China play fair.
Meanwhile, Rob, we've been watching the stock market go up and down in this country. One of the things that investors are worried about is the situation in China and the Chinese economy. There's a story today in the Wall Street Journal that says, in fact, things are worse in China than officials there are letting on when it comes to the effect of the tariffs. What do we know about what all of this trade war has done to the Chinese economy?
Yeah, it's difficult to see that from my perch in Shanghai and actually even Beijing. But, you know, when I talk to economists who are looking at import, export data, there seem to be a lot of problems developing. There's been a lot of chatter among Chinese economists about this in recent months. And the consensus is that, yes, China's economy and its growth is slowing more than anticipated. This is backed up by lower than expected consumption numbers and from announcements like we saw recently from Apple CEO Tim Cook that his company's numbers would be worse than expected due to China's economic downward trends.
The other thing that's happened since the last round of talks, Rob, is the arrest of that Huawei tech executive, Chinese executive in Canada, and then the Chinese arrested several Canadians as well. Is that likely to come up in these talks, or is that going to factor into the entire trade conversation?
Yeah, I think that will be part of these talks for sure. You know, China saw that arrest as a politically motivated arrest. And President Trump actually went so far to say that he may use the arrest of this Huawei executive as leverage in his team's talks with the Chinese. So that pretty much confirmed Beijing's suspicions that it was a politically motivated arrest, despite the fact that the Department of Justice in the United States seems to have legitimate concerns about her actions with regards to the violations of sanctions on Iran.
That's NPR Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz as another round of talks get underway between the U.S. and China. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And at least in early trading today, Wall Street seems sort of optimistic that they may be able to reach a deal. We'll see. You're listening to Here and Now. At the Golden Globes last night, Bohemian Rhapsody picked up the prize for Best Drama, Green Book won for Best Musical or Comedy, and the Netflix show The Kominsky Method won the prize for Best Television Series, Musical or Comedy. It's a show about aging in Hollywood, starring Michael Douglas, who also won for Best Actor.
And I guess this has got to go to my 102-year-old father, Kirk, who is... Alta Cocker's rule! Okay.
That's a Yiddish expression for old fart. Michael Douglas has now won 3 Golden Globes and 2 Oscars in his long career, which has included many signature roles.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. I don't know what you're up to, but I'm going to tell you it's going to stop right now.
No, it's not going to stop. It's going to go on and on until you face up to your responsibilities.
What responsibilities?
You have made me the happiest piano player who has ever lived.
I spoke with Michael Douglas a couple months ago in front of a crowd. He was accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Betty Davis Foundation at the Boston University Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center. I began by asking him, after a montage of his films, what he thought, looking back.
50 years. It's a joy, you know, it's how you spent a good part of your life. I'm very happy. I love my work, and I like the balance, the mix.
Are there roles that you see yourself doing there that it was a question of whether you would do them?
Yeah, well, there are ones that were more dangerous, let's say, in terms of the outlook, the kind of gray area, which I seem for some reason to be attracted to. I look back, and without any real purpose, my entire career has been pretty much contemporary. I only have, I think, one period picture out of about 60 that I've done. Maybe it came out of I was in college in the 60s when the Vietnam War was going on, and we all of a sudden got into a period of that gray area. And so I've always been sort of attracted to that mix, that there's a degree of larceny in all of us, but the hope and belief that we'll do the right thing.
Well, and there are films that you have done, a number of them, that have been certainly current, but also influenced the thought of the time. I'm thinking of Wall Street, of course.
Right.
Unfortunately, you didn't fix the problems on Wall Street with that movie, but when you do a film like that and people are talking about it and it changes the dynamic of the moment, do you feel that it has a bigger impact than you thought it would when you decided to do it?
Well, that one was sort of a challenge, and we were very proud that we kind of captured the zeitgeist of that moment. But that was one where, yes, I get identified with that the most, and people love Gordon Gekko, you know, and if I get one more drunken Wall Street guy coming up to me, you're the man, you know, yeah, you're the man. I said, hey, I was the villain, remember, I went to jail. Ah,
right.
Oh, no. And so all of a sudden you realize that I thank my costume designer. They liked the clothes. They liked whatever it was and didn't see through. So, I mean, that one sort of surprised us all.
Well, what is it about you that even when you are the villain, you're a likable villain, that the audience can identify with you?
Jeremy, I think you hit upon my biggest advantage, my biggest thing. And I was not clearly aware of this until we were doing Fatal Attraction.
Yeah.
And we had our first screening of Fatal Attraction. It was right after my first scene where I have an adulterous moment with Glenn Close. And I came back to my apartment, and there's a scene where I get in the bed and I take the sheets and blankets, rough them all up to make it look like I've been in the bed that night. Mm-hmm. And the audience laughed. And the producer, Sherry Lansing, turned to me and said, "I can't believe that they've forgiven you already." And I have been blessed with, I guess everybody has their element that people will let you go a long way and allow you to get away with a lot before it's too much.
Well, the other thing about you, and I say this as somebody who works in radio all the time, is your voice is amazing and still is. I mean, I was watching a clip that was from the 60s, and you had it then. You had this voice.
Well, I had a little bit in the 60s because I was always telling you, I did this television series, The Streets of San Francisco, and my first awards were in Germany because the show was syndicated around the world, and I went over to Germany to get this award for the show, and I thanked the audience and everything, and also I could see these whispers in the German audience going, "Was ist das? Was ist das?" And then I went and saw Streets of San Francisco, Nostrasse San Francisco in German. I had this great profundo, this great German, this great deep, deep voice. I sounded like a little wimp when I was sitting there, you know.
Do you have to take care of it?
Well, I took vocal lessons before Wall Street, actually, was when I did some work on my voice. You know, since then I've had cancer, cancer of the tongue and in the throat. My voice has changed, but it seems like it's holding up okay.
So that brings me to another thought that I had when I was thinking about that is my father is a classical pianist, and he has always been very worried about his fingers. He, like, if you dropped a $100 bill on an escalator, he would not get down and pick it up because he doesn't want anything to happen to his fingers. When you were diagnosed with tongue cancer, that must have been a very, very scary thing for you.
Well, yeah. You could say that. Yeah, no, we actually, we presented as throat cancer because I was stage 4, and the likelihood of having your tongue removed is not the best thing for an actor,
right,
or for anybody, for that matter. And so we didn't like the connotation, so we thought we would, you know, change the interpretation. Yeah, that's always a, you know, any cancer survivors know, and you're happy to be here. And I actually lost 2 friends who had similar cancer at that time, and was very grateful to have behind the candelabra after that.
So you're in a new show on Netflix called The Kaminsky Method, which people should watch if you haven't already. The show, I mean, it's about aging.
Yeah.
What drew you to that at this moment?
Chuck Lorre wrote the show, and it's a comedy about getting older. Well, I said, if you can find anything funny about getting older, I'm your man. let's do this. And so it was a beautiful written pilot, and I hadn't thought about it at all at this time. But this streaming phenomenon, which is really this Silicon Valley having come into Hollywood and taken over in a very, very short period of time, is fantastic. Because, you know, streaming has no commercials. You can say anything you want. And basically, I can do a season in the amount of time that it takes to do one feature film. And that's what attracted to me. All of a sudden, it was a part that was age-appropriate and dealt with issues of older people, hopefully in a humorous way, in most cases.
Well, somebody dies of cancer in the first episode.
Very funny. Very funny.
You've won 2 Oscars, one for producing and one for acting. Producing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, acting for Wall Street.
Right.
What made you want to produce in the first place? Because it's something that a lot of actors now do, but you were doing it when that wasn't the case as much.
It was solely by chance. I was fortunate enough that my father had owned the rights to the book, had it adapted into a play, and then afterwards he had tried for a few years to get it made into a movie. He couldn't. I had started my career after college, was working, was sliding into episodic television, and I heard that Dad was selling the project. I said, "Look, let me try to run with this, and I'll get it set up for you to play the part." Mm-hmm. And I tried for a few years, finally got it set up, and by that point, time had gone by. My father was a little older. Of course, he's never forgiven me for this. And I understand it because it's one of the great parts in your life. But it was the passion for that project. I loved that story and had the opportunity.
Your father's 102 now?
He'll be 102 next week.
Wow. He'll be 102. So yeah. Was there an intimidation factor for you in following in your father's footsteps?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I had no interest in acting, you know. It was the 60s. I was in Santa Barbara, California. I was a hippie. You know, University of California, Santa Barbara. Finally, I think it was my third year, they called me to the chancellor's office. I was a junior, and they said, you know, you have to declare a major. Huh? Yeah, you got to declare. You can't keep taking general education courses. You got to declare a major. I said, oh, I don't know, man. Maybe theater arts. I figured my mother was an actress and my dad, but I had no interest, so I came to it reluctantly. And I wasn't very good. Dad was the first one he came up to see those first shows. You know, you were terrible.
Really?
Yes. Well, I mean, he rightfully so. I mean, our union runs at about 90% unemployment, and I think he was very worried after what he saw. And so I was a grinder, and I just kept at it. But yes, of course, anybody else, a father and son business, but in ours, someone would say, that's just like your father, and you're trying to create your own identity. So for me, that year of it was a kind of a combination of Fatal Attraction, followed coming out 2 months later with Wall Street and winning the Oscar, was a big moment for me because I really felt it was the first time I was outside the shadow of an extraordinary career, an extraordinary man.
Michael Douglas, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I spoke with Michael Douglas in November. He won his third Golden Globe last night for his work in the Netflix show, The Kominsky Method.
Today is inauguration day for the states welcoming new governors. They include Wisconsin, Minnesota, Wyoming, California. We want to take a closer look at the historic change in California, where Gavin Newsom is being sworn in as that state's 40th governor. He laid out his vision last November on election night.
It's about advancing all Californians on their journey by making this a place of equality, making California a place of opportunity, safety, and affordability for everyone.
And, of course, Gavin Newsom replaces Jerry Brown, who's leaving the office after a record 4 terms. And after Newsom officially takes the reins later today, it'll be the first time in more than a century that California has had back-to-back Democrats as governor. Ben Adler is Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio in Sacramento. He's at the state capitol for the inauguration coming up. Ben, hi.
Hi, Robin.
So Gavin Newsom has been looking at this chair for years. He's been the lieutenant governor, former mayor of San Francisco. What's the mood like there, though? Because, you know, Jerry Brown leaving big shoes.
It is, I think, both wistful and anticipatory. And, of course, that depends, you know, who you work for, what your politics are and the like. But it really is the changing of a guard. Jerry Brown, the oldest, longest-serving governor, record 4 terms, spread across over 2 stints in the 70s and 80s, and, of course, up until today. Gavin Newsom, much younger, a newer generation, but his family has been tight with the Brown family for years. And so California, a state of nearly 40 million people, is about to get its 40th governor.
Well, you understand that Gavin Newsom's wife has already made a change.
She is requesting that she be referred to as the first partner rather than the first lady. And it reflects in part her activism for women's rights and for equal rights. And so I think that's one change that is going to take place right off the bat.
Well, and Gavin Newsom is expected to speak about inclusivity. Now, we know we've been hearing all day how Jerry Brown used to, you know, throw some Latin in or some references to Doonesbury when he spoke. What's Gavin Newsom expected to talk about?
Well, I don't know if we'll get any Latin quotes or not. Maybe he'll toss one in as an homage. But he will draw a contrast, as he has done throughout his campaign, with President Trump. And he'll say, quote, "We will prove that people of good faith and firm will can still come together to achieve big things. We will offer an alternative to the corruption and incompetence in the White House. Our government will be progressive, principled, and always on the side of the people." Newsom did campaign for many progressive policies, including single-payer health care, although he has indicated that maybe he will need to, at least in the short term, look at universal health care as well as universal preschool. And so certainly staking out ground for progressive policies in California.
Well, and this is interesting because Jerry Brown was considered by most for decades one of the most liberal lawmakers in the country. The Associated Press refers to Gavin Newsom as being more to the left than Jerry Brown. And we see when he's going to announce his first state budget later this week, one of the proposals is to expand California's paid family leave program for new parents from 6 weeks to 6 months. That would be the most generous of any state policy in the country. But how is he seen in the state? Is he seen as that left-leaning?
Well, that's a really good question. And here in California, he's been regarded as much more of a centrist. Newsom has said, look, we will be prudent fiscal stewards, but at the same time, we will be bold.
Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, awaiting the inauguration of Gavin Newsom. Ben, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, forests play a key role in curbing carbon emissions. According to the latest National Climate Assessment, America's forests stored the equivalent of 11% of the country's CO2 emissions over a 25-year period. That's because when trees suck up carbon dioxide, they release oxygen from the CO2 and store the leftover carbon in their trunks. But just how much carbon gets stored in a tree? Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill went looking for answers.
When Bob Merritt goes into the woods, he takes a tool with him. A hammer, his magic sonic hammer.
It's not called a magic sonic hammer. It's called the sonic hammer, but I call it the magic sonic hammer just because it looks kind of cool.
Mara is a biologist with the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station, and while his hammer isn't magical, it's about to do something pretty cool. Help us look inside a tree. To do that, Mara hammers nails into the trunk of a sugar maple in northwest Connecticut, girdling the tree with sensors. Then he circles, tapping on each nail. Each tap is recorded by a very polite computer.
Please, measurements at this spot have been recorded.
Mara's recording sound waves, measuring how fast sound travels from the nail he hits to all the other nails around the tree. It's called sonic tomography. It's like a CAT scan for trees, a way to peer inside a trunk without drilling to see if a tree is rotting or solid wood.
The denser the wood, the faster the sound waves.
Dense wood is really good at storing carbon, but if a tree is less dense inside, that could indicate decay, and also that the tree might not be as good at storing carbon as we think. Using a grant from the National Science Foundation, Mara tested his tomography idea, scanning around 70 trees in northwest Connecticut. He found dozens were rotting inside, even ones that on the outside looked healthy.
What's going on inside of these trees, it's kind of hidden to us for the most part. Trees that otherwise look to be perfectly fine and you would have no reason to think otherwise can have internal decay taking place.
Mara says that's an important consideration, especially when it comes to carbon storage or sequestration.
If we're going to look to forests as a way to sequester carbon, we should develop much more accurate estimates of how much carbon is actually sequestered.
Because, well, there are whole markets based on this. Like in California, its aggressive pollution regulations have fostered an expansive cap-and-trade program. California polluters can offset emissions by buying up carbon credits, and landowners across America can profit by proving their forest is really good at storing carbon. Rajinder Sahota is with the California Air Resources Board, which oversees the process.
What you do is you have a measurement at the beginning of that time period that says, here's how much is in my forest.
Then, through yearly audits, landowners prove their land over time can store carbon in a way that's better than business as usual.
Here's how my forest looks relative to what is the common amount of stored carbon. And here's how much, if I undertake some activities, I can increase that carbon storage in my forest.
But measuring all that? Well, here's where it gets tricky.
You look at any tree, especially a hardwood tree, and look at its shape. I mean, that's really complex.
Christopher Woodall is a researcher with the U.S. Forest Service. His equations are used by California to calculate stored carbon.
You estimate the volume, and then you got to figure out the biomass within that volume, and then turn that into an estimate of carbon.
To do that, foresters don't go out and look at every tree. Instead, they sample, measuring a variety of trees and plugging those numbers into a complex model. But forestry science is evolving. Woodall has since published work saying the equations need to be improved, in part because new technologies are making biomass estimates more efficient and precise.
I think we're not too far away from not necessarily sampling trees in the U.S., but actually having a true census. Eventually, with a combination of satellites and with drones and laser scanning, we're headed to the point where we might be able to know something about every tree in the U.S.
He says that could happen soon or in 50 years. But for now, scientists are taking baby steps, trying to assess the role of forests and climate change. Because, as Woodall says, it's too important to ignore. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
There's a lot of buzz about last night's 60 Minutes interview with self-described radical progressive Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but human rights activists were glued to the talk with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who apparently had second thoughts after his sit-down with Scott Pelley because an official from Egypt, which is a U.S. ally, called to try to get the peace pulled. In it, President Sisi, among other things, denied to Scott Pelley that his country has political prisoners.
Do you have a good idea of how many political prisoners you're holding?
We don't have political prisoners, nor prisoners of opinion. We are trying to stand against extremists who impose their ideology on the people.
Now, Human Rights Watch reports that there are, in fact, 60,000 political prisoners in Egypt. Sisi also denied ordering the killing of hundreds of protesters in 2013 in Cairo's Rabah Square. So how did CBS land this interview and decide to air it against Egypt's wishes? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been looking into this. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
So CBS was advertising this 60 Minutes piece as the interview Egypt's government doesn't want on TV. What happened here that we know? Because he, of course, wasn't forced into this interview. Did the Egyptian president actually think 60 Minutes would not ask about human rights issues?
Well, it's interesting. Scott Pelley, the correspondent, 60 Minutes' producer, sat down for an extended conversation, what they call 60 Minutes Overtime, about the process behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they said was they made the case that if Sisi really wanted a major platform to address the American public and opinion makers, as well as perhaps the larger world of influence leaders, which Sisi appeared to want to do, that 60 Minutes would be the right place for it. And they talked about the number of world leaders and Middle Eastern leaders who have done that over mm-hmm. the decades. They, however, refused to relent to repeated entreaties and then pressure from Egyptian officials to preview the questions, mm-hmm. to say, here's what we're going to ask, here are the topics we're going to do it. They said, you know, we have to have free range to do it. That's the way that's the deal you strike with 60 Minutes is there's no deal.
Well, with most, we should say with most interviews, you can't see the list of questions beforehand.
Well, major news organizations like NPR and CBS don't do that, but there are individual, you know, interviewers who might strike a different understanding. 60 Minutes wasn't going to sway to that. And, you know, Egypt obviously has a lot of questions both domestically and on the world stage about how it handles dissent. It is an incredibly repressive regime.
Yeah, okay. Well, last week we reported on Netflix agreeing to Saudi Arabia's demands that Netflix pull an episode from comedian Hasan Minhaj's show Patriot Act. This is the one in which he was critical of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman after the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Let's listen.
Just a few months ago, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a.k.a. MBS, was hailed as the reformer the Arab world needed. But the revelations about Khashoggi's killing have shattered that image. And it blows my mind that it took the killing of a Washington Post journalist for everyone to go, oh, I guess he's really not a reformer. Meanwhile.
Big laugh there. But so David, Saudi Arabia said that episode broke one of their laws against impinging on public order, religious values, and public morals. So Netflix said it removed the episode to comply with that law. So now you have Egypt asking CBS in 60 Minutes to pull an interview. CBS doesn't. Are these apples and oranges to you? How do you view these two incidents?
They are apples and oranges, but they are not they're both fruit. They're both worth looking at. You know, these are cases in which CBS News and 60 Minutes in particular stood up for its right to report what it had gathered legitimately and wanted to disseminate as a matter of public interest. In the case of Netflix, you know, in an entertainment streaming service seeking, you know, as its founder and co-founder and CEO Reed Hastings has said on an earnings call for investors not long ago that, you know, global expansion really is where it's at when it comes to increasing profits for Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's seeking to get the largest markets it can. The Saudis basically made clear they felt this violated local law. But Netflix also has its own prestige, even among Saudis, as well as viewers worldwide. And Netflix had leverage, as the special rapporteur for the United Nations for Freedom of Expression told me last week. You know, major corporations with global reach have the ability to say, we understand your concerns and yet we have our interests as well. And they had to make a decision that they might well spark being banished from Saudi Arabia for now, but that might be a stance they were willing to take. Instead, after doing some legal review and kind of dragging their feet for a couple weeks at the end of last month, they pulled the episode.
Yeah. Okay, listen, while we have you, there's other news in the land of CBS. We just have to ask you about Susan Zirinsky, longtime news producer, who also inspired a character in the 1987 movie Broadcast News that's heroic to many of us. She's sort of a female leader of a news division. Let's just listen to this scene. She's played by Holly Hunter, and here she's in an exchange with her boss. Let's listen.
It must be nice to always believe you know better, to always think you're the smartest person in the room.
No, it's awful.
Susan Zirinsky was considered by many to be the smartest person in the room. Quick thoughts on her elevation.
She's tough. She's smart. She's been there for over 45 years. It's a way of CBS putting a new stamp after a time in which her predecessor was not himself tarred by scandal, but had to oversee a lot of reactions to a lot of tumult internally, both over Me Too and other issues at the news division there.
This will be great to watch. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. I've got a new favorite phrase. These are apples and oranges, but they're both fruit. This is Here and Now.